just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Well, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. This could be one of the toughest investment climates that I have ever seen. It's very difficult for someone to decide between risk-free investments like treasuries or CDs.
Well, hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Jimmy's doing something over there on the board. I think he's using his toes as well as his hands, but he's getting there. SP Futures down 31, NASDAQ Futures down 100. Do we have Professor Lou?
Yeah, I think I'm here.
Yeah, well, there you are, bud. How are you?
Good. How's Chicago?
It was all right. I was warm yesterday, but not too humid, so it was okay. I had a meeting last night with a couple of former judges and a couple of attorneys, and these are like real attorneys, Lou. You know, the feet on the ground kind of guys. We're telling stories about bump court, hooker court, riot court back in the day. You know, you never did anything like that.
Well, I actually did do criminal work, but criminal work is always more, always has the best bar stories or cocktail party stories, because especially defense, because your clients are, you know, idiots.
Pretty much.
I was talking to a friend of mine. We were one of the younger associates, and I said, you know, there's a film called The Big Chill, in which one of the characters graduates from college and they're sort of back together again after 10 years. And she goes into law and she becomes a public defender and then changes to environmental law. And they're asking her why she made the change. And she said, I just didn't understand my clients were going to be so guilty. and then she says, now my clients only rape the land.
That was a great movie.
That was a fantastic movie. Anyway, it's
incredible.
Mary Kay Place's character.
What a couple of the interesting stuff with in the essentially the hooker court. These are all different places too. The hooker court was on 11th and State.
There's enough misconduct in Chicago that you can have specialized courts.
Yeah. Well, he said one night the guy goes, well, we got. Well, they had all different kinds in there, right? So the dude goes, we got like 10 people here are transvestites. Where do we put them? And with the men or the women? And the judge goes, if a guy's been surgically sawed off, put him in with the women. Otherwise, put him in with the men. I guess that's does any of you guys actually been fixed? And one of the guys raises his hand. He goes, okay, you can go with the women. you can't write fiction like this, Lou.
It's, you know, it's the kind of gritty, I guess is the word I'm looking for, gritty confrontation with reality that most of us just don't have to worry about.
No.
And because there are people, police, public defenders, certain courts, judges, who, you know, take this on as part of their public obligation. And it's... it's hard. It's hard work.
Well, I didn't realize that the bond stuff, you know, which again was a big, you know, was a big deal the last year when, you know, whether it's cash bonds and all this stuff. But apparently the bail bondsmen have been out of it for like forever, and so the bondsman became the state.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize until you learn something every night, or every day, and every night, that the lawyers got a kickback on the bond. So one of the high end law firms decides it was like in riot court or something, or it might have been bum court. I don't know. There's two guys that ran those courts that were the public defenders. So this big law firm decides, okay, we're going to send one of our guys over to represent some people like out of charity. So the two guys write the law firm a letter and they go, we don't want your guy here, But they send a guy anyway. So the guy shows up, and evidently he represents somebody. And there's a big commotion out in the hallway, and one of the guys, who's now a judge, was a clerk at that point, and the judge goes, go out and see what's happening. The two guys, one of the guys who's a regular and the other lawyer, in this big fist fight, because it was $1,000 bond, and you have to put down 100. So the guy puts down 100, but evidently the lawyer got a chip or a receipt for 90 bucks of the 100. So the guy wanted the 90 bucks off the guy who just represented him, and they're fighting over it.
I swear. This is the kind of stuff that, again, I did criminal law, but I did it in a very organized, you know, kind of setting, which was the military court system. I've never done it in the civilian side of the house. And all the stories I heard about, you know, criminal law, it just made me say, you know, I don't want to get, I mean, some of the cases are really interesting. White collar criminal law, which is, you know, basically defending corporate misconduct, is interesting and you know, higher stakes or high stakes. But the day-to-day dealing with the guys who are out murdering, robbing, raping, pillaging, the whole bit, there's nothing appealing about that to me.
Yet the guys and thank do God, that thank they don't God make that much money either, Lou.
No, I know. Thank God it appeals. Thank God it appeals to some people.
It's a whole different world.
Yeah, I was called for jury duty last week, and by an act of some miracle, got dismissed before I got called into the jury room to be voir dired. But I just thought, you know, I was running through in my head the criminal cases I'd been involved in, because I knew I was going to have to talk about it at the jury panel. And my criminal law background was varied, but at the same time limited, because, you know, the military manages to screen out most of the really bad guys. So we when we get cases, they tend to be, I mean, you'll get the occasional murder or aggravated rape or some, you know, other major crime. But, you know, what is a day-to-day occurrence in, for example, Chicago criminal courts are very rare in military courts, and they're organized differently. So I say I've had criminal law experience. Yes, I've had to stand up in court either representing the state, or I think I did one defense case, but stand up and say, okay, I'm going to bring the power of the state to bear on this, you know, this person or these persons. But it wasn't what I really wanted to do, and I'm glad there are guys out there willing to do it.
Well, even the judges, before you land in like one area where you're there for a while, like the one guy is in a child something something child court or whatever, but he along the way you're in traffic court for 6 months, you're in divorce court for 6 months. Because the traffic court, you would think it'd be easy. It's not. He goes, those guys, there's a story coming out of there every day. But it's, you know, you wouldn't think that anything would be, you know, normal. It's just not. It's that normal.
Tom, people, and I don't know whether our cultural depravity has gotten worse or we're just more aware of it because of cell phones and people's lack of inhibition of being shamed, but people do stuff. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I practice employment law. Employment law is like family law in a corporate setting. In criminal law, the stuff people, just think about the stuff people do in cars.
Yeah.
While they're driving.
Yeah. You
know, just, I mean, it. Anyway, speaking of prostitution, I wanted to lead off with the fact that the House settlement, get our sports and law segments out of the way early.
By the way, somewhere along the line here, you got a comment on this plane crash. It only made it 400 feet in the air.
I saw. It's terrible. But I want to talk real quick about the House settlement. And what's happening now with that? So I'm reading the settlement last week, and it's like an 80-page order from the court on approving the settlement. And sure shooting, yesterday, a lawsuit was filed under Title IX of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which deals with equal pay or equal financial contribution for women's sports as men's. And they are challenging, they're challenging the settlement on the grounds that it deprives the women of equal compensation under the provisions of Title IX. So this is probably the first lawsuit and the most obvious one that was going to be brought in, because the minute you start talking about funding these kinds of things, and based on market share, you know, women's sports, absent the occasional Caitlin Clark phenomena, women's sports are right up there with, you know, men's whatever. And so they're not, you know, not, i.e. not football, not basketball. And so there's going to be a fight over this. And, you know, there's a good, I think the Trump Department of Justice has said they're not going to go after, or the Department of Education has said it's not going to go after NIL settlements that are pursued through a separate vehicle. They're not going to go after those as part of Title IX. They're saying this is a separate payment based on market share. On the other hand, you know, there's a pretty good case. You can make a pretty good case saying this is not discriminatory, because there's a story about the women's softball World Series, collegiate World Series, and I think the Texas Tech team or the team that ultimately won it has a female pitcher who got something like, the report I heard was $10 million in NIL money as a woman. So a court looking at this is going, well, this really isn't a marker of discriminatory intent. It's more a marker of what the market's willing to pay.
Can I back up a second? We don't need to
step in on this.
I know I interrupt more than I should, but can I back up on this whole thing? I talked about it yesterday, and I got into it a little bit, and then in the middle of my conversation, I go, wait a minute, this is a job for Lou. I didn't read you're reading the thing. Now, in my economic Southside mind, the Supreme Court essentially came down and said, the schools do not own somebody's name, image, and likeness. So,
correct.
Dr. J's brother Paul, the late brother Paul, who's a terrific guy, unfortunately died of MS, Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. He actually had an offer to do, and he was in acting, to be like a flannel shirt guy for Kohl's during the summer, and they told him, "Nah, you can't do that. We own your stuff." Now, to me, if somebody were to sue them, and I'll use the term girls because two of the girls from some team in Georgia, if somebody were to walk into court and said, I had an offer from this modeling agency or whatever 10 years ago, and here it is, and you guys said no, and it turns out that you shouldn't have said no, I would think that if anybody has some sort of redress, that's what the Supreme Court case, in my opinion, sort of addressed. And from there, all this other crap blew up. The pizza joints putting in money for the team so they get a better team, and all this alumni kicking in money and all this crap. I don't think the Supreme Court envisioned or even addressed any of that. So if I'm somebody who just, you know, I'm a fat old second string tackle from 20 years ago, why do I think I deserve any dough? I had no offers of anything. I'm sure as hell wasn't me a model. I never got off my dead ass to go speak or work at a hospital or a pizza place. Why do I think I deserve any dough? Now, if somebody had an actual opportunity and was forced to say no, that I'm all for. How does this become this general thing?
Well, because the breakout of money very quickly came down to who's the superstar and who's just, you know, yeah, a bit player.
I don't think that's what the Supreme Court intended. A superstar that just played football, they never said he deserves dough for football. They're saying that if he wants to market himself, he can. Where did the second part come in?
Well, it comes in, Tom, because of a fiction that is being promulgated through this whole system, and the fact that we can't pay, or we're not going to pay, these kids individual contract salaries. At least that was the start of it. And so you end up with basically, what was the movie? Sky High, where you have superheroes and sidekicks. So the superheroes are drawing the big bucks, and the sidekicks are getting whatever's left, whatever they can do on their own. The schools very quickly said, we're not gonna allow this system to be set up. We're gonna make it more of a sort of a communist or socialist system, and so we're gonna have separate accounts for the guys who can go out and negotiate the superstar money, and then another account for a sort of generic team NIL fund that will be distributed equally to all the sidekicks. And that's the thought process. And so because they weren't allowing players initially to go out and negotiate.
But 90% of them had no desire to do that.
Exactly. 90% of them had no desire to do it and no ability to market themselves.
I actually think the women probably had more of a ability.
Well, certainly the attractive ones did.
Yep.
I mean Livy Dunn at LSU, who is very pretty and in great shape, was making mega bucks.
Well, they can also talk.
Yes. Yes, she was making, well, I mean, not always if you, I mean,
but there's women there that you can, I mean, the what's his name, Red Bull does not mind having Hidalgo as the face of her company.
No, but what I was about to say was, given how women's sports have developed, you're getting just as many inarticulate female athletes as you're getting these days. Go watch a WNBA interview.
Well, you had Caitlin Clark was on Saturday Night Live. You're not going to put half the guy football players on Saturday Night Live.
No, that's true. But you're not going to put half the men's basketball players on there either.
I'd say more than half, but that's just
yeah. Anyway, the point that I'm making is, this is why, to answer your question, this is why this developed this way. And so one of the things that jumped out of this settlement process right away was a number of athletes, many of them women, coming forward and saying, look, you've put a $2.2 billion pot of money out here to compensate people going back 10 years, but you're undervaluing the women's portion of that pot, because of that pot of money. And Dunn was one of the ones that complained about it the loudest, because she said, you're crediting me with X, but I'm actually making like 10X if you look at what I was earning in the last 4 or 5 years. So that's one challenge. The retroactive compensation is going to violate Title IX because it's undervaluing women's contributions.
Lou, why does this not expand to assistant coaches that were locked in at like $60,000 up until how long ago?
Well, that's a separate issue, because they're not.
But is it free snowball fight for everybody at this point?
It could be. That's a separate issue. That's not a Title IX issue.
No,
that's not a discrimination issue.
But it's an NCAA rule.
An antitrust issue.
But it was an NCAA rule.
Yeah.
That caused people to either not get paid or get paid less than they were worth.
Right. So that's a separate antitrust issue. This settlement has been engineered specifically, I think, to do things like often happens in lawsuits. It's been engineered to do things that you probably couldn't do under normal legal circumstances, which is, between two parties, settling litigation allows a certain amount of collusion. And that's what they're doing. But to go back to this point, the you've got a Title IX track for the previous payments, the $2.2 billion payments, where plaintiffs are saying, and I think that's what the first lawsuit says, are saying this is unfair to women, it's undervaluing their contribution. And oh, by the way, there's a provision in Title IX that says we're not even looking for discrimination. It doesn't matter what the intent is. If you're not paying the same, then it's a violation. That's one Title IX theory. So that's one half of this issue. The other half of the issue is going forward. The bulk of this $20 million a year in NIL cap is going to go to basketball and football. And so there's going to be a huge fist fight over women's sports, and are we, how are you compensating them? Now, as I said, the Trump at DOE has said that they're not going to look at NIL money under the settlement as Title IX, you know, a Title IX payment. But it really, I think the colleges are stepping, doing what I didn't think they would do, which is stepping back in to administering this thing under the terms of the settlement. And the minute they do, I think this all becomes Title IX eligible again. So this is the first start of the litigation.
Lou, from the economic side, can I give you my view of where the economic breakdown, for lack of a better term, is here? I think that you have the economic line in the sand that you're talking about, and I'll try and explain it in economic terms, which probably doesn't have anything to do with what these guys are thinking, but there's two groups in the college sports. One group makes money and one doesn't.
Yeah, the haves and the have-nots.
Well, no. I'm not talking about the participants. I'm talking about the sports. One makes money and one doesn't. And fencing doesn't make any dough. But if the woman or the guy fencer happens to be the best-looking male or female on earth, they are now free and have been for a while to go out and cut their own deals and be in the cover of God knows what, beauty magazine, male or female, or whatever else they're trying to do. They get to do that. That's kind of the Supreme Court thing, and maybe what all of us sort of agreed. And there's the other issue, which is, to me, and I think, economically, totally separate. And the separate part is the friggin' football team's making $80 million a year, or 100 or 200. Yep. And by the way, everybody's making a fortune except the players. And damn it, the third-string tackle deserves some dough because he's a friggin' employee, getting his head beat in, and he's out there every day sweating his ass off. Now, but that's totally separate, in my mind, economically, from the original lawsuit. It has to do with by the way, should these people participate? Now, for a long period of time, I'm going to say 10 years ago, and Kevin, I think, would agree with this, he hates it when I say that he would agree with me, is up until 8 to 10 years ago, the 70 grand scholarship that you got to go to Notre Dame was probably sufficient pay for everybody except maybe the starters in football, and or certainly the stars in football, and maybe the starters in basketball. I mean, if you're going to be on the men's soccer team or the women's swimming team, 70 grand was probably plenty. It wasn't like you got nothing. Now it appears for football, the stuff has run up so much with these conferences doing what they're doing, that 70 grand is nowhere near enough. It's probably still enough for the women's soccer team. It's probably still enough for just about everybody else. But, you know, and there's some schools that isn't 70 grand or 80 grand. But now, you know, what do you do with those people? They should be paid more because, by the way, if it wasn't for them, there'd be no football team. So to me, there's an absolute split between the Supreme Court intent and just the economics of the other situation. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and there's a and then you drop on top of that Title IX,
yeah,
which says we don't care whether you're discriminating based on gender or anything else. If you're not paying the women or setting it so that the women have equal participation and equal funding generally, then you're in violation of the statute. And so this gets pretty convoluted. And it's gonna, and then throw in on top of that the fact that you've got the establishment of this quote commission, that college sports commission, that is going to take the place of the NCAA in regulating payments under this NIL system. And we are going to be back very quickly to, you know, cash filled envelopes under the table to players.
We got to head to break here in a minute, but you know, I think, hear me out on this one. I think it's going to happen. And I, by the way, nobody knows more about this Title IX is more articulate than you. I think you're going to end up taking men's football and men's basketball, and you're going to make it a something somewhat separate from the university, so it's not counted in Title IX.
Well, and this is something you and I have talked about before, but there's a really good article, I'll try to find it and send it to you, that talks about the entry of venture capital into college sports. And one of the big startup funds have set aside $500 million to invest in college sports. And we talked about this, what, 6 months ago? With
At that point, they won't be college sports, Lou.
Well, that's right. But they, the BlackRock came out and said, we're going to set up a 70-team college super league that is going to handle football. And this is the next move, I think, because college administrators are going to this Title IX stuff has the potential. If you think tying up Donald Trump has been an issue with federal judges, wait till you get in front of a bunch of federal judges who believe that Title IX is the be all end all, and therefore they're going to start issuing injunctions against the NCAA against these college teams from operating based on the fact that the colleges themselves are administering the fund.
Well, if you ever get to the point where somebody's dumb enough to think that the college football quarterback playing to 100,000 people is worth the same amount as the lady fencer when you don't even give a crap if you have a fencing team and nobody knows who they are, you got an economic IQ of about 4.
But that's what Title IX does. That's the whole point of it. That it was designed to try to shut down that market-based result. And so
well, that was when you were limited to scholarship, so too.
Well, right. Yeah. And so the point here is that there are all kinds of incentives, illegal and financial, to move this thing to a private operation as quickly as possible. And I think that's ultimately where
it's already there.
But I mean, moving the NIL program away from the schools to a private run.
The Alabama football team is already a quasi-professional operation, somewhat sponsored
absolutely.
By the school. I mean, it's, what is it, Form Follows Substance? Yeah, they all are.
I mean, all of these big schools. And so, you know, the next step is, okay, the government wants to regulate this through Title IX. They want to equalize the payments. You know what? We're going to take this away from the schools. We're going to put it with a group that's willing to put $500 million into our program and our programs across the board. They'll run the playoffs, they'll run the rankings, they'll run the media, and we don't have to worry about it, and we can get back to educating people, which supposedly is what we're supposed to be here for. That completely alters the nature, as you've said many times, of college sports and fandom and allegiances and everything else.
Well, my guys are still all over this, and I must have got, I don't know how many texts this week about the Irish scoring a couple of guys for a basketball team. You know what, Lou? I love the fact that I went there. I love the friends I made there. It's not my school anymore, and I could give a rat's ass whether they get two guys. Because if they are good, they're going to be gone after 1 year anyway. What's the difference?
Yeah. It's hard to build allegiance. Well, I mean, I'm a Duke fan, and I can't. It's hard for me to keep track of who they've got coming in and where these guys go. And I get it.
Is this where I put in my shot about your baseball team losing to the other guys?
Oh, no. That's fine. You know,
the other guys played hard. I watched that series. The other guys played hard. So does Duke. But it was a good series.
That's why you play them. You know, that's why you play them.
Howard. That's why you play the game. Remember that?
But this is going to fundamentally alter the college sports. And it goes back again to something I've been saying among my Air Force Academy circle. The service academies, which have always prided themselves on being able to compete at a Division I level, are going to have to figure out something here because they will lose. They have a 2 year. You know, you can leave after 2 years there. They are going to become talent like every other division. You know, low-end Division I and Division II school. If you get a kid who comes in who suddenly blossoms as a player, they're going to get siphoned off.
But you're going to let's go to break because I have a feeling the more we go pro model, Air Force is going to get paid for that guy. SP futures down 33, NASDAQ futures down 117. Nobody's going to get them for free. Why should they? Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Well, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. This could be one of the toughest investment climates that I have ever seen. It's very difficult for someone to decide between risk-free investments like treasuries or CDs, corporate bonds at all-time low rates, or the stock market, which right now is somewhat unloved. On the other hand, if you have wealth, you are an investor and should be concerned about income and risk. Like everyone knows by now, the PTI Securities has a 14-year investment program called the Protect Index Program that has served our clients well for a long time. I think, however, that people associate that program with new cash investing, and that is somewhat true. What you may not know is that PTI also uses the same concepts and risk parameters to help clients with individual stock positions, especially a concentrated stock position. How many of you have your stock sitting in a brokerage firm where, if you ever felt the need for protection or income enhancement strategies, there'd be no one with a clue on how to help you? Are you really comfortable with those large concentrated stock positions? Ever think of talking about ways to possibly adjust the risk or income potential? It can only happen if that stock is in an account with a firm like PTI. And again, I can't think of a firm like PTI, with the Chief and others averaging 15 years of floor trading. Give us a call or contact PTISecurities.com. It's PTI Securities.
Got something on your mind?
Give us a call about your stock. 888-76-JOCKS. That's 888-765-6257. Or email us stocksandjocks@live.com.
Well, the best place to get things on your mind is off.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm tomorrow with Jim Lawler on the board. SP Futures down 32. We were down a little bit more. NASDAQ Futures down 113. We have PPI coming out today. I don't know if that's going to have any, if there are any increases in the prices because of tariffs. I don't think they were in the CPI that came up yesterday. Next month should be more interesting, maybe. PPI today might, since it's a little more looking ahead, might be some stuff in there. We will see at 7:30. Dow futures down 277. One of the issues, Boeing's down 1780, under 200, 196.20 with this airplane going down. We'll talk about with Lou in a second. They're hauling people to hospitals, so the thing was only 400 feet in the air. So it looks like they got a lot of survivors. They're in what kind of condition there? It doesn't sound good, but at least there's some people appear to have made it. DAX down 270, it's 1.1%. UK economy shrinks more than expected. Europe is going into a recession, and I think we're with them. I hope not, but I think so. FTSE down 6.07, CAC around down 56.7. So the one that's not down is the one who admitted their economy shrinking, so that's a little interesting. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei down 248.6%. They've been up. Hang Seng's down 331, 1.4%. That's a give back, but it's a big chunk of a give back. Shanghai's up 34 cents, so flat, so they're not reacting at all, really. Bonds down 3 base points, 4.37 for the 10-year. The Bund bound down 6, 2.47. And Japan down 0.01, which means they're 1.44. Oil. These guys have had the big run up this week. Now today they're falling back 1.17%. 1.17 is the dollar 17. 1.7 is the percentage. 66.98. They were 61 forever, but all these tensions in the Middle East. We're going to have Lou explain that while we're pulling people at embassies or something. Brent down $1.14, 68.63. Natural gas up 13 cents, 3.63. RBOB down 3 cents, 2.13. Gold with a big rally here today after being down yesterday. Up 58 bucks, back up over 3,400, 3,401, just over 3,400. Silver up 12 cents, 36.39. Copper unchanged, 4.80. So a lot of stuff going on here this morning. Foreign exchange, dollar down to euros up a whole penny to almost 1.16. That's a pretty big move. A British pound is up, not a whole penny, but 0.03. They're back at 1.38. So the dollar's been a little weaker lately. Crypto down 1,700 bucks, still at 107.074. A lot of stuff there, Jimmy. What do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports, Cubs lose again.
You're hearing me now?
Yes.
Okay. I had it down. Again, it is the 12th of June today, and again, both Sox and Cubs lost. Cubs lost to the Phillies. Phillies beat them 7-2. Sox lost to Houston. Houston beat them 10-2. Diamondbacks did beat the Mariners 5-2. If you didn't watch last night's Pacers game, it was very chippy, and I thought it was a good game. Pacers won 116-107 and take a 2-1 lead. Next game is Friday. And tonight we have the Panthers versus the Oilers. in traffic, we have the inbound Kennedy to from Montrose at 10:16 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook is 19. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 26. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is 10 minutes. And the inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan at 26. Weather, Chicago is right now at 65, a high of 73. Again, we will continue to have hazy sun from the wildfires in Canada. It'll be clear tonight and down to 61. In Phoenix, currently 81, a high of 109. Again, we have danger of heat stroke or extreme temperatures tonight. It will be a clear but low of 80. Back to you, Chief.
Lou, what, just the first 787 to go down?
Yes, according to Boeing. First one with a major accident. So all I've seen, and I don't want to speculate because there are a million. At takeoff, there are a million things that can go wrong that cause you to lose the jet. But the flight tracker data that I've seen says it got to 625 feet in the air, and then went down. It looks like it went down in a residential or occupied area. There are a lot of buildings there. The tail of the aircraft was embedded in what looked like an apartment building. I assume there will be casualties on the ground, but I don't know.
Sounds like a lot of people are going to hospital, so it's not everybody dead, it doesn't appear.
I don't understand how there can be any survivors based on what I saw.
Oh, you saw it? I didn't see it. I was just reading.
The pictures of the crash site, the aircraft is disintegrated. It's torn apart. It went into buildings. So the plane is torn apart.
Did it blow up?
Yeah, big huge fire. Conceivably, people. Yeah, I mean, the miracles happen, but it was probably going over 120, 140 miles an hour when it hit the ground, at least, assuming it stalled out. Anyway, the crew got a mayday call off, so whatever happened, slowly enough for them to at least hit a call on the radio. It could have, we don't know when it happened. It could have happened on takeoff roll. They get above a certain speed, and your only option is to try to get the jet into the air and recover. So if they, for example, you've got a speed called V1 and V2, and past I think it's V2, the jet has to take off. You there's not enough runway left for you to stop it, and so you get past that speed, and as you're coming past that speed, let's say you blow a tire or a bird hits an engine or something like that. You don't have any options. You got to get the airplane into the air and try to recover. They got the aircraft.
Can these things, if an engine blows, are they capable of taking off with one or not?
They are, but depending on takeoff weight and everything else, it was not. I don't think it was fully loaded, but depending on takeoff weight, depending on the temperature of the air pressure, everything. But theoretically, yeah, you can get the aircraft into the air on one engine if your speed's great enough. So, they get the aircraft into the air and try to recover it, or they could have taken off, got up, something major happened in the aircraft that distracted the crew's attention, and they lose the jet. But whatever it was, it happened. It wasn't like a catastrophe. It doesn't sound like a catastrophic failure of the airframe, which would have caused the plane to pitch over and go in right away without them being able to get a radio call off.
Lou, I've read some stuff, and I don't know if this makes any sense whatsoever. Is it U.S. pilots as opposed to foreign pilots? The airlines want you to switch to autopilot sort of almost as soon as you leave the ground.
This came out in the 737 MAX crashes, and that's exactly right.
But the U.S. guys don't ever want to give up control until they feel like it.
They don't switch. They don't switch to autopilot right away. They may maintain control of the jet. The 737 MAX crashes was a factor in terms of training, and that may well be something here. I don't know. We just don't know enough. But whatever it was, it happened slowly enough for them to get a radio call off, which indicates to me that it was likely something that happened on takeoff roll or right afterwards as they were getting airborne, and they realized they had a problem. They were trying to get the jet under control, and I mean, according to the eyewitnesses, I haven't seen video, obviously, but according to eyewitnesses, it just flew settled. It came down level in level flight, you know, into the ground. So, you know, it didn't roll over on a wing. It didn't nosedive. It just settled in. So they could have lost power. They could have, I don't know, who knows.
Well, how far up do you have to be to? I mean, at 400 feet, you're there. You're there pretty damn fast, right? And in a normal takeoff, and you really can't start to turn until you're what, a couple thousand feet, or? Well, they turn pretty quick.
I mean, they turn pretty quick. It depends. It depends on the departure. It depends on terrain. But generally, you know, once you're airborne, you get a couple hundred feet separation from the ground, and you'll begin a bank turn. And I'm trying to think of the airports. I mean, the old Hong Kong airport used to be like that.
Well, I can tell you one. You were flying to Jackson, Wyoming?
Yeah, Jackson.
Yeah, they have to absolutely corkscrew out of there. They can't.
Jackson's got one. If you fly into Telluride or into Aspen or some of the mountain airports, you have fairly significant maneuvering right after you take off. So, yeah, I mean they could have maneuvered, but it sounds like from the reports that I read, it sounds like they weren't. So, I mean, it's awful.
Well, Boeing doesn't need any more trouble, and we don't need more people getting killed.
Yeah, I would be surprised if it was some kind of systemic catastrophic failure. Of course, you have all kinds of nationalism and everything else rolling into the accident investigation. It's going to be crucial, and I don't know whether the Indians will let Boeing look at it. It's going to be crucial to get to the black box as quickly as possible and download that data and start analysis. And I assume they're looking for it now, but this is not a crash out in the field somewhere. The plane went into buildings, and I can't imagine that there are survivors. It's tragic, and we gotta, you know, there's I think something like close to 1,200 of those airplanes flying worldwide, so they're gonna take a quick look at.
I was never all that anxious to hop on one of those. I want my metal. I don't want a fiber.
But they're I mean, they've been very reliable, Chief. I mean, they've
I just wonder how they're gonna age well. If you're gonna see those in the air after 35 years like the other ones.
Yeah, I don't know. I flew home from Europe on my first time on an Airbus 380, which is the giant double decker.
Well, that's a big, huge 4-engine job.
Yeah, aircraft. Now, I think they've had them in O'Hare for a while, but this was the first time they were. This was like the first month of their service into Denver nonstop from Europe. I would love to be able to tell you I noticed a huge difference. I really didn't, except that we did seem to lumber off the runway coming out of Germany. So it's a huge airplane, and getting on it and getting off it is an experience when you come into an airport that's designed for airplanes with 200 people on, and suddenly you disgorge 650 people into the terminal at one shot.
I forget what airport we were taking off of, Audrey and I were going somewhere. And we were on a 67 or a 77, 57. And they're using, I don't think it was O'Hare, but it was some, we were maybe two-thirds down the runway, and that's where everybody was pulling in and taking off, right? And I'm looking out the right window, and I see this 747 way the hell down. It was a racetrack, you would have called it the mile chute or something. He's like, he had to be way more than a quarter mile away. So all of a sudden, the guys that are pulling out from where we were stop. And this thing, the wings are down. It almost looked like a B-52, and I'm going, this guy's got to be going as far as he can go, as loaded as he possibly can go. And the dude starts up. And when he went by us, in like the seemingly like it was a quarter mile or more, maybe 3/8 of a mile, Lou, I don't think the dude was going 70 miles an hour yet. And then I quick looked out the other window. When he gets near the end of the runway, the thing kind of takes up and off, up and off he goes. I'm going, that thing had to be within a pound of maximum of maximum capacity. I don't know where the hell the guy went. He must go around.
So I'll give you one war story, you can take it for whatever it's worth. Shimya Air Force Base is an Air Force Base on a piece of rock out in the North Pacific. It's a awful place and was, you know, used during the Second World War. We use it now to stage reconnaissance flights out along the North Pacific for various important things that happen there. But the runway is not very long because it's obviously limited to the size of the island, and the island's not very big. And it's like a lot of those islands in the North Pacific that's volcanic rock jutting up out of the ocean. So it's basically, you know, cliffs on either end of the island. And so an aircraft called the RB-47, which was a B-47 that had been modified for reconnaissance, this is back in the 60s, starts its takeoff roll, and it's shooting down the runway, and they hit a bird. There are lots of birds there. They hit a bird, and they lose, you know, back in those days, they lose the engine. So they're going too fast. It's you know, horrible, misty, rainy weather. The control tower watches this aircraft. They see the flame shoot out of the back of the engine, realize that the aircraft's lost an engine, and it's right at max takeoff weight anyway. And so the aircraft goes through the overrun at the end of the runway and just drops, you know, goes right through the overrun and off the edge of the cliff. And they just, they don't see any ejection seats. They start to call for emergency response, and all of a sudden the aircraft emerges out of the mist at about 10 feet off the water.
God.
Flying, you know, still flying, screaming along, and then very slowly it comes back up. And you have to wonder, you know, the adrenaline hit that those guys, that front end crew had, watching that airplane pitch off the end of the cliff. And you know, again, this is your training kicks in. You know, they always tell you the first thing you do when you have an emergency is to fly the airplane. Never forget you got to fly the airplane, and that's got to be your focus. Don't worry about the checklist. Keep control of the aircraft, and that's what this.
I'm sure you've seen it 100 times. With the Doolittle raid, there actually is a film of those things going on.
Oh yeah, I've seen it. Where that guy takes off and looks like he's going to go right into the ocean.
Yeah, the guy who's got the flags. The water is not exactly calm, so what the guy's doing to help the planes off is he's sort of anticipating when the bow of the ship is going to be going up to help to give the plane a boost. It's barely getting off anyway, right? So he kind of miscalculates on this one wave. I'm sure this is what you're talking about, which, you know, is a pretty damn tough job. So the guy miscalculates, and all of a sudden you see this plane go off the end, and it totally disappears. And you think, oops, he's in the drink, and sure enough, then you see the thing coming up. It had to be just like that, Lou.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It, and, of course, you know, I interviewed Doolittle.
Really?
I had a chance to talk to him for about 3 hours. And I asked him a little bit about that, and his, you know, he just said, I had literally planned that down to the pound in terms of fuel, in terms of, you know, the weight of the crew members, the bomb load, and it was absolutely just a razor thin edge of performance for those aircraft. But we had, you know, and he said, and then it was compounded by the fact that we had to launch, you know, a couple of hundred miles further out than we wanted to, and so none of the they lost all the aircraft. None of the aircraft made it to the landing zones that they had projected. And he said we pretty much figured it was a suicide mission from the get-go anyway, and he said it was amazing that we didn't lose any aircraft on takeoff. They all got off the Hornet.
You know what, we're always kind of befuddled me. I don't think the Hornet was the biggest aircraft carrier. Weren't there a couple bigger? Why didn't they use the biggest one? Wasn't the Lexington bigger or Saratoga?
Because they needed to divert it away from combat operations for some extensive, you know, training for those guys, and you know, load the aircraft on it and get it out to sea. And so they didn't want to take Enterprise and Lexington and what was the other flat top? They didn't want to take
the main. Saratoga was already down.
Yeah, they didn't want to take the big flat tops out of combat.
All right, what's going on in the Middle East? Should we be buying oil here or what?
You know, two interesting things. We start the evacuation of our people, and now there's apparently a story in the New York Times, and I can't tell. I assume it's leaked by some of the anti-Israel elements in the State Department and DOD that want to negotiate with Iran. The Iran expert holdover from the Biden people.
Well, okay, back up here. Wait, how many in the Iraq embassy right now? Nobody's heard. Iraq hasn't been on the front 10 pages in 5 years. How many people are hanging around in the Iraq embassy, and what are they doing? What exactly is our relationship with Iraq now?
Well, we have a number of people in that embassy, and we still have active military operations in that area, and we have air bases there. So,
who's Iraq even governed by?
It's governed by some, you know, combination Islamic jihad Ba'athist remnant political.
Are they sort of our buddies?
They have elections, so I don't know what the formal name of the party is, but we've still got a presence there.
Are we bad guys? They hate us. They like us.
It's been testy, but. You know, they understand that if we're not there, the Iranians come across the border, you know, forthwith.
So we have a couple of bases. There's interaction between their government and our embassy, somewhat normal.
We have a military presence there. We have a status of forces agreement with the Iraqi government. I think there's coordination on counterterror operations and things like that. So we've got a presence there that the Iranians can hit. We've got a presence in Syria that the Iranians can hit, although it's not huge.
How are we getting along with the new guy there?
I think there's some concerns, but I know that we're trying to set up trade relationships with them.
But he has not turned out.
We've lifted sanctions on them.
You predicted that he was about as bad as it gets. He's been better than you originally thought, or no?
Well, he's so far. I mean, his people have engaged in massacres of Christians to the extent that the Israelis felt necessary to step in and go into Syria and set up a cordon around outside of Damascus to protect the Christian Druze population, who are traditional Israeli allies.
Why don't these guys always have enough energy when you're looking to plant crops and feed your people around and kill people? It seems like they never run out of energy or bullets for that. There's always enough bullets, and there's always enough chutzpah for that, not for the normal stuff.
And this is something we don't really grasp. So, for example, Hamas, you know, operating in Gaza, we keep saying, well, we have to provide relief to Gaza because, you know, eventually it'll settle down, and I don't think it's going to settle down. But notwithstanding that, there are all kinds of leaked accounts that the Israelis are getting ready to hit Iran, probably by themselves, although we may be providing intel. The question is what have the Israelis done with respect to bunker busting munitions, and how good their intelligence is. And if they do, you know, do the Iranians try to nuke Tel Aviv, or do they try to launch attacks with their proxies across the Arabian Peninsula to strike Israel and maybe Saudi Arabia and a few other places. So you know, I think the kicker, frankly, the trigger for our evacuation was maybe some indications from Israel, but this international agency report today that said the Iranians have cheated on the nuclear inspections and have not complied with their obligations under the existing treaties. So, okay, you now have an international body that says that they're not complying. They've told us they're not going to comply. They've told us they're going to continue to enrich, and this is their right. And everybody says, okay, we know that's code word for we're going to get ourselves a bomb as fast as we can, and that's where it's headed.
Look, they're not good guys. You're never going to get me to argue about that. How and going forward 100 years, how do you tell somebody they can't have a bomb when everybody around them's got one?
Well, everybody around them doesn't have one.
Well, we think Pakistan does. We think Israel does. We think, you know.
Well, we think Israel does. Pakistan supposedly does, but the Saudis don't. The Turks don't.
Jimmy, you're getting a blowback here.
Yeah, it's coming in. I think from Andrew. Our response to them is, listen. You guys have acted like homicidal maniacs for the last 40 years. You know what? We're not going to let you have a bomb. You know what? You want to develop nuclear energy? Don't act like homicidal maniacs.
I get it. What? Just in terms of if my buddy Lou Michaels gets, if you're the ambassador to Iraq, or how many people you have work for him, and say he's got 20 people working for him. Is everybody's whole family there normally? They all live in the embassy compound. I mean, I've never been to an embassy. I'm sure some of the listeners haven't
typically,
either.
Typically, they will have their families with them,
and they all behind the fence in a house, or
yeah, they live in the embassy compound.
So it's not like walking down Michigan Avenue and saying there's the Irish embassy. It's one building. There's a fence. There's soldiers and there's houses where people live.
Yeah, because our interests there have been subject to truck bomb attacks and a whole bunch of other stuff.
So it's 20 acres, 30 square mile.
I don't know how big the compound is.
Right. So you're.
Probably, I think it's in one of Saddam's palaces.
So you're. There's a school for the kids. There's a bar or two and a restaurant.
Typically, there would be some kind of recreational facilities there, but I don't know what we've got, and I don't know what kind of access they have to the rest of Baghdad.
The thing that's always kind of stuck in my feeble brain, Lou, is when I was going to say your buddy, he's not your buddy, the Mole Man took over. Where the hell was he? Libya. This is way back. I mean, I was probably still working for Pullman, and all of a sudden he starts to do some stuff over there, and all.
We're talking about Gaddafi.
Yeah, and I should have explained that. and all of a sudden, we don't like the guy, and he's kind of doing all this weird stuff. So we've got all these oil workers over there, right? And so they go, and I've got to remember this to this day, Luke, because I kept thinking, boy, Americans are, for lack of a better term, are stealing everywhere. Now, these guys are consultants in the oil fields because he nationalized the oil fields, didn't he, or something?
Right.
And so they go, okay, non-essential people should probably get the hell out of Libya. So, you know, something like, 20,000 people leave or some huge number. And then all of a sudden, like 2 weeks later, it's like, man, if you're not actually working in the oil fields, you better get everybody out of there except for maybe your wife or something. It's like another 10,000 leave. And then all of a sudden, it gets really critical. They say, okay, we're moving the last 15,000 out. I'm thinking, God, we had like 60,000 people over there just, you know, getting paid for doing God knows what in the middle of nowhere. But are we everywhere? We must be, huh?
Yes, we are, and that's one of the reasons why we're such tempting targets for kidnapping and other stuff.
Well, what do you got going this weekend? Anything good?
Head to the mountains. Going to be up in the mountains for the weekend.
Well, is it Monday a holiday?
I don't know. Is it?
Is it Juneteenth or something?
No, it won't be a holiday for me. We'll be working.
Yeah, I'll check this. But I think the exchanges might be closed. But Luke, thank you. Good stuff. What about Boeing? Boy, it's back up. It's all gonna
depend on what that black box says.
No matter how bad they hit, no matter how bad the fire, those things are always okay or no?
I think a black box would. I mean, it's possible to destroy a black box, but I think this impact probably did not destroy those things.
We don't. So even though they claim they're hauling people to hospitals, we don't know of any survivors on the plane. Really,
I would be. I mean, miracles happen. I would be a survivor in those from those pictures that I saw would be a miracle.
All right. Well, let's hope for better than that, buddy. S&P futures down 35. NASDAQ futures down 136. Andrew, Jimmy, you want to go right to our guys? Or you want to go quick break?
Why don't you go right to the guys?
Right to the guys. Okay. We got the boat of you guys today, Wayne and Andrew.
Yeah, you got the full Monty here.
Well, good. First of all, Andrew, how did your last week thing go, buddy? How are you?
I thought he was here.
Well, he'll be back in.
I'm here.
You are. How did your shindig go?
It went great. It was a town hall in Ithaca, New York. How does federal policy impact the county? And a humorous note, it started out with one of the state legislators saying, look, we're a county that's got a university, so we're on the naughty list. And here's how it's going to affect our budget badly. So,
what's the university there? I should know this.
Cornell.
Okay.
And the concept briefly was, it was my 55th reunion, and I thought, well, I can go up there, talk to my sports and student newspaper buddies, but there's big things going on in Washington. Why not organize a town hall, get the local officials, the professors, and the public to talk about what happens in Washington affect people? And it was very interesting, and a fair amount of work to pull it together. But, for example, some people said, well, we can't come, the Palestinians are going to, demonstrate. But, that's fears that were not realized.
Oh, God. It's everybody's a little tense. I mean, that's for sure. Pretty much all over the place. I was trying to get some information out of Lou, and he was, I don't know why I've always been sort of curious about all this embassy stuff works and who gets to go and how long you have to stay and how miserable the existence is when you're there and, these compounds and the families and the schools. Have you guys ever been to one of these foreign embassy kind of places?
Well, Wayne knows a lot about
that. I had a short stint with the State Department where one of my tasks was it was the Bureau of Diplomatic Security, and they, of course, secure U.S. diplomatic posts around the world. But in the case of Baghdad, if you remember, it was built in the Green Zone. That was that area of Baghdad that was supposedly safe from attacks, although the local Shia militia are pretty good at lobbing mortar rounds into it. But it was built by George W. Bush, that administration, as the largest U.S. embassy compound in the world. And people were like, what in the world do we need something like that in Iraq for? I don't think that question was ever answered satisfactorily, but they had everything in that compound. They had all sorts of things for families, schools, gymnasiums, and so when they reduced the embassy staff to bare essential personnel, of course they get all the families out, of course. The people that would remain would be like the Marine security contingent, probably the ambassador, if there is one there, but definitely the chargé d'affaires.
What the hell is a chargé d'affaires? It seems French.
Well, that's usually a deputy chief of mission. The State Department, like all foreign ministries, they love that French, because French used to be the diplomatic language of the world. As a matter of fact, it still is the official diplomatic language of the Vatican.
Really?
And and of course, whoever is CIA station chief will remain, and that's usually somebody operating under what they call diplomatic cover. But all the other people would be, the people that process visas and all those would be sent, evacuated.
Well, now, is there a road from there to the airport to get out, or has everybody got to get a helicopter? How does that work?
Oh, no, no, they would, I think the highway out to what was formerly Saddam Hussein International is open, so they would just, but now whether they might use a charter flight to get them out, or maybe even a military flight.
And how many places are being, just those guys, who else is getting?
Apparently Baghdad, Kuwait, Bahrain, and Qatar are all being.
Well, I was kind of surprised at those places, are you? I mean, I thought those places were pretty secure.
Well, they are, but one of the things Iraq has threatened to do, Iran, they said if the U.S. is involved in an attack on Iran, they're going to go after all U.S. interests in the Gulf area, so that takes in quite a few.
Do we have any idea what their capability is? I mean, what is their... I mean, I'm sure somebody does. How good is their Air Force? I mean, it seems like they're getting their ass kicked everywhere. I mean,
well, we've seen what the Houthis can do with those intermediate range missiles from that hit Israel.
Yeah.
Well, they come from Iran. So.
Well, to go back to one of your points, Chief, how do people get around? Probably 20 years ago, I was running a convention, and I wanted to get a top person from the cell phone industry and a government official to our convention in Silicon Valley. And they explained to the audience that they take helicopters at 100-foot level. And here's the reason. If they're up higher, some sniper will take them out. But if they fly low, they appear and they get going safely before anybody can pull out a gun and say, oh, here's a helicopter, let's shoot it down.
Really?
So, but the trick is you don't want to fly too low or you'll run into a telephone pole or some other obstruction. So that's one of the ways to get around, but it's all risky.
Does somebody really want to bring his family to one of these places, or you just sort of have to?
Well, yeah, it's a part of the Foreign Service career path. A lot of the embassies are unaccompanied tours in countries that, you know, where there's a lot of terrorism or civil wars or whatnot, so you wouldn't find families necessarily there. It's the same thing with some military duty stations. Some, like the ones in Germany and Spain, you can bring dependents, but in other places, you're there without the family.
So it's a far cry from the Irish embassy, like here in Chicago, with just a nice building or something. Somebody lives there.
Everybody wants to get invited to events at the Irish diplomatic missions, especially around St. Patrick's Day.
Well, what is a guy like Rahm Emanuel doing in Japan for 5 years or 4 years when he's ambassador to Japan?
And Andy and I are quite familiar with Rahm Emanuel, and I can't imagine that he made many friends over there.
Yeah, I was going to say probably irritating people, Chief.
Like he's back to irritating people in the Democratic Party now by threatening to run for president.
I saw that. Who, I guess my question would be, it's the first name I've heard. I mean, who's in the bullpen?
Well, I mean, as a result of what's happening in California, remember, Governor Newsom decided he was going to invite all these people onto his podcast, like Joe Rogan and Steve Bannon and a couple other of these ne'er-do-wells, and his stock in the 2028 forecast went down precipitously as a result of that, and since he's been standing up to Trump over this situation in Los Angeles, apparently so have his poll numbers. So he's definitely back to being a contender, but you've got you know, Kamala Harris is still considered somebody who would be a contender, although I think she may have her eyes on actually the governorship of California after Newsom.
Interesting. I never thought she had a whole lot of talent anywhere along the line, but that I don't know. I don't know. I guess it just seems what there appears to be some people that are you know pushing these rioters a little bit, and it's pretty interesting. And one side, a couple of the judges I was with last night, are convinced it's the people on the right doing it, just to inflame it. And of course, everybody else is convinced it's you know Soros or somebody. I mean,
yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah, no. That okay. So having I used to cover the anti G8 and anti World Bank demonstrations in Washington D.C. back, if you remember, in 1999 and 2000. Early 2001. There was.
Hey, wait. So, what's the difference?
Yeah.
Who's the added creature when you go from the G7 to the G8? Who's the eighth?
The eight was thrown out. That was Russia.
Okay. Oh, okay. So it's back to G7,
right? Back to G7, right? Now Trump wants to bring him back in to be the G8 again, but I think he's the only one that believes, you know, is in favor of that. But what was noticed back in those anti, sort of, say globalization protests, were the presence of these guys in wearing totally black outfits, what do they call them, baklavas, the sort of masks, and these would be the ones that would be taking rocks or ball peen hammers and breaking the glass of the Starbucks along the march route. And this was first surfaced in Genoa at the anti-G8 protests there. They actually caught the local carabinieri, the Italian police, changing into these black outfits behind an alley, and they were caught in other locations as well. So we know presently that the Proud Boys are talking about going into these areas, and the Black Lives Matter protests, there was actually one of these guys from one of these right-wing militias that went up to Minneapolis. And he took a hammer and he was busting the window at an auto supply store that was closed. And then he was coaxing people to go in there and loot it. And they, you know, they wouldn't do it. Of course, they weren't going to fall for that. And I think the idea that there's agents provocateur trying to get
nobody knows who they are. I mean, why didn't
they're masked, but we don't know.
Well, why don't we capture a couple of those guys and find out who they are? Lone Ranger.
I agree. And if the police were doing proper police work, they would grab these guys. It's just like these fake ICE people that are coming around. They look like I call them Meal Team 6. They come around, they're apprehending people and taking them to God knows where, and so ICE actually put out a notice saying, look, our badges look like this, and it's and they said, and if it doesn't look like this, it's somebody that ordered it off of Amazon and they're fakes.
A simple way to think about it, Chief, is if they're causing violence, they could be ultra right or ultra left or both, and they have a mutual interest in creating disturbances that are beyond peaceful protest.
The one building we used to be in here, we were there forever. The government had all kinds of. You guys, the building. Well, it's got two addresses: 175 West Jackson, and it's a. One something something Van Buren. It's a full square block. It's the third biggest square foot building in the city outside the Merchandise Mart and the Sears Tower. And they had alcohol, tobacco, firearms. They actually had a holding cell in a place. And once in a while, you'd see those guys coming at night with somebody. I think maybe ICE might have been there too. Social Security was there. I mean, has there been a big? I don't know if there were that many people. I mean, that work for ICE? Where did, is this? Is, have they expanded big time? I mean,
there's a suspicion now that they have contracted some of their work out to private players. Now, who? Nobody knows, because they say, well, that's, you know, that's national security, blah blah blah, whatever. And but there's a fear that even some of the January 6th people may have been hired on as ICE employees. It's called a personal services contract. It's easy to do, too. All it is filing some paperwork to say, look, we can't do everything. We need this one person has the credentials that we require. And, you know, it doesn't have to go very far up the chain to get, so it's get that approved.
Equivalent of like a deputy?
Or even, a deputized, essentially deputizing a civilian as a law enforcement person, right?
Well, they used to, some of the guys on the Bears, I think Walter Payton was one of them, used to get deputized by the county police so they could carry a gun.
Well, remember Herschel Walker, the guy that ran for, you know, football player that ran for senator, he got one of those badges. He was trying to say he was a policeman, and of course that contributed to his defeat in the election.
Oh God! Well, Andrew, what exactly is what kind of pinch is Cornell feeling, or they're just kind of getting ready for it?
Oh, it's huge. The county legislator, Deborah Dawson, said, well, let me interrupt and answer your question. You were talking about Cornell. They've got a $1 billion hit on their research funding that was ordered by the Trump administration 2 months ago, and that's partly what prompted this. And so that goes to scientific, medical, agriculture, other types of research. And since it's the largest employer in Tompkins County, that has all kinds of ripple effects as research stops and people lose their jobs, it's a tax base, and so forth. So to take it to the county level, the legislator speaking at our town hall was talking about a potential 14% hit on the county revenue, compounded by whatever the state hits are because of diminution, coupled with an increasing need for services because the nonprofits are going to be hit from their federal funding, whereas people are going to be asking for more safety net services. So the prediction was this will start to hit a few months down the road, but that people have to realize it's a huge impact because everybody's going to be saying you've got to raise local taxes, and people are saying we pay enough. How can we do that?
Yeah. The reason why I ask, Andrew, maybe we could one week actually kind of talk about this. I have a feeling you guys know more. We had a young lady on the show a couple times, and she was in medical research, and she was a graduate of Loyola, a really bright girl, and she ended up doing something for Minnesota one summer, Northwestern one summer, then Minnesota, then Vanderbilt, and they did a breakthrough on some orphan disease where they found the DNA spot where the people in your DNA where it's different to why you get this orphan disease. Now, that doesn't mean they have a cure yet, but at least they found it, and she gave a couple of presents. Anyway, she was doing really good for herself, very articulate, and we got into this discussion, you know, me being economic knucklehead, always trying to follow the nickel. She said it's amazingly complicated that it, like a place like Vanderbilt, which does a lot of research, and obviously so does Northwestern. She goes, there's research doctors, either PhDs or doctors, that'll do some research on maybe, you know, pick, the one I always pick is, say, sickle cell anemia. Well, you might be able to get some donations from regular people. You might be able to get general donations to the college, or the university, maybe you can get something out of Washington or some other place or a foundation or somewhere where every one of them has like its own almost accounting thing going. Every like disease, for lack of a better term, or research you're doing. When stuff comes from the federal government, is it a combination of all that crap, or do they just give Cornell, you know, here's $1 billion, go do something? Or I mean, if it's $3 million for this research on this particular project, how the hell do you pull that? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, when people say $1 billion for research, from what she said, it could be cut up in a zillion different ways. I mean,
oh, it is. It absolutely is. And by the way, the same announcement 2 months ago that hit that announced the $1 billion funding cutback for Cornell also announced $700 million funding cutback for Northwestern. So you've got the same concerns up there in Evanston, but it's definitely carved up into small pieces, like you just said. And so what happens is individual departments will work on these grants and shepherd the grant through the process. But what the reaction by DOGE and is, no, just all of it's out. And at these departments, you got scientists and the administrators saying, what are we going to do here? We've got experiments and research and students that are expecting to be paid, and we're in the middle of whatever we're doing. But it's individualized projects, but the people who know what's going on, they're basically researchers and administrators, not people who are capable of fighting for their project in Washington.
Well, Andrew, how do you, I get the feeling from a lady who was here and a few other people I've talked to since, that of course got me so curious about the thing, is it, Doge wouldn't be my style, but I think there's a boatload of graft in this whole mess. When I say that, I think she told me that, was it her or somebody else, that if I were to give, you know, $2 million to said sickle cell research, and it's at Northwestern drops like some huge overhead rate on that project for the use of, like, their facilities and stuff. And I'd sit there and go, wait a minute, I'm not paying the administrators at Northwestern. I want to pay for this project. I mean, I know you have to have some sort of labs and stuff. I think those numbers are off the chart ridiculous. I mean, I don't think Doge was smart enough to know where I'm coming from here, but they're just going to pull the project. I don't know that that's where the problem is. I think you know what I'm saying? I think there's a lot of, I won't use, like, I guess I already did use the term, excessive overhead, shall we say. It's like when you look at, you know, the schools in California. I just did a study one day. There's 10 indirect employees for every professor, and I'm going, what the bleep? I mean, how does that work?
Well, it can sound bad, and in fact, you on this program drill down a lot more than a lot of our news media is capable of. And in fact, I was just fascinated to hear you and Lou go from women's basketball to Iraq in the previous segment. But if people are truly, truly interested in finding waste, fraud, and abuse, and the Inspector General program was created under Jimmy Carter in the 1970s, why did the Trump administration fire virtually every Inspector General in every department 3 months ago? Because these are the people who are supposed to find out exactly what you're talking about. And if you fire all of them, how are they going to find out what you're talking about?
Well, how do they become sort of immune, just part of this wall of bureaucracy where nobody, you know, I know my dad was a policeman. He died young. I barely remember him. My mom used to tell stories. She would say, you know, virtually every one of the policemen that he knew were really good guys. Yet there's every policeman knows five people that shouldn't be on the force. You know,
that was the power of that movie going back Serpico.
Yeah, and you know, you wonder if the people after at a certain period of time, do they retain their independence? I mean, does the police group that checks out other people's discharges of weapons and something, are they truly independent? Can they be, can you be that guy? I mean, you can be Tom Selleck in Blue Bloods. I mean, is there really anybody who's capable of doing that? I mean,
Well, there's some people, but what we're systematically removing, and it's no accident, is any ability to know who's the good guy and who isn't. So if there's a view, anybody who's got a job in the inspector general, fire them and bring in new people. All right, you're playing to a certain meme or theory that anybody who's got a job must be corrupt. But on the other hand, why is some 20-year-old Doge nerd presumed to be honest?
Well, I'm with you on that. You guys, the one time we met, I mean, I wish we'd had time for cocktails and stuff, but wherever I go, I seem to bump into people. And since I've been doing the show and talking to guys like you, I just have this incredible curiosity about things that I kind of always had a little bit, but nothing like now. And Audrey and I go to dinner at his place, and the guy next to me start, you know, me BSing with somebody. Imagine that, right? And I'm talking to the dude, and it turns out he was, in his younger day, he's older than us, but he was a basketball player and played at a mid-level college and then organized all these tournaments for people in high school and college. I said, well, what was like your real job? And he said, well, I was a inspector for I don't know if he was FBI or what the hell he was, but one of those outfits that was inspecting all the goings-on in the savings and loan crisis back in the day. And he goes, I was out at Silverado. And he says, every time I bumped into some person who was obviously very much involved in all the crap, but the name was, and I start digging and I find all the stuff and I tell my boss, the next day they got me like on another guy. I mean, but I think, I don't know that Doge was a solution to that, but there's, somehow or another, we don't dig. I mean, you guys have been around this more than me. Like every year, the quote bureaucracy kind of gets a little worse, and I don't know how you shake that up. And Clinton, I think, shook it up a little. How do you do that? I mean, do the people really, really go in and say, "What are you doing here?" One of my, I don't know, he's in Denver now, but or Steamboat. My attorneys used to work for the the SEC. Because like every day, you got stuff, you put it on one side of your desk, you go to lunch, you go to break, you put it on the other side of the desk, it just works its way through, and nobody seems to know where anything's heading or where it's going or who's pushing it, and all of a sudden one gets pushed and one doesn't, and there's a man behind the curtain everywhere, and it's really bizarre. I mean, is that true?
Well, there's good people working there, and in a functioning system, which we have, if people know how to look for it, you find the right people. Here's a well, I got two stories running in my head, but here's
all right.
One.
Well, one then the other.
Yeah. All right. So one is I'm appointed general counsel of this high tech association, and the big problem, there's all kind of fraudsters around. And they're scamming things, they're putting infomercials on early morning TV, and they're saying essentially, oh, you can get a license for this new technology, wireless through the air, just send it in $5,000. Well, it's a scam, and it was hurting the actual development of the industry, wireless industry. So they couldn't prove it. Fraud, it's very hard. You have to have a mental component of bad hand and the bad mind. But I was fresh from University of Chicago Law School, and I realized that for securities fraud is like a parking ticket. There's no mental element that there is in like robbery or shooting somebody. It's like a parking thing. You're over time, you get the ticket. There's no, and so securities fraud, you have to register. And so what I did was created a dossier, and I went to the Securities and Exchange Commission and handed it over to people who investigated all these crooks. And we invited the Securities and Exchange Commission to come to our convention in 94. And they told the people, those of you who are crooks and are selling unregistered securities in early morning TV, we're going to get you. And that cleaned it up. And so we were able to find the right people at the regulator's office to clean up the crooks and allow a new industry to be transformed. So there are people in there trying to do their job. They're not.
Do they get so frustrated and leave?
Well, a lot of them are leaving now because there's a kind of, you're all bad. You've been working here. You must be corrupt. So get out.
Well, my view, just to wander off a little, like I always do. We are dealing with FINRA and other people. Those are our regulators. And by the way, we're undergoing an audit now, and I'll try and keep my mouth shut about that. But when we first started, the audits came from the CBOE, from NASD, could be the Amex, could be New York Stock. They all rotated around. And you actually would have people who would come in, and especially if we were such a young firm, they'd say, God, you can't be doing it this way, guys. Do this. You know, what's the matter with you? I mean, there were guys that knew the business, and now it's, they get, for those people that don't know, and you're probably going to be horrified when you hear this, FINRA is actually a for-profit group. So all the exchanges basically offloaded all their FINRA is, for lack of a better term, a contract kind of place. I mean, I'm sure they would agree with that, but they make their money essentially by fining people. And, you know, the new mantra is the audit is just kind of an ongoing thing where they send you stuff every day. They don't used to come in and do it and spend a week and get tired of being there and tell you what you did wrong and if you did anything wrong or not, and you talk to them, and it was a pain in the ass, but it also was somewhat of a learning experience, to be honest. And now it's just a constant, somebody sits someplace, thinks up something to, you know, to lob at you, and they lob at you, and everybody's an expert, and what are you doing this? And they, you know, they take these small firms like us, you know, we got five people here, and they got six people working on us. I mean, what are you doing? Not to mention that we go through two clearing firms as where every cash is. We couldn't steal if we wanted to. And I you know, you wonder, where is this going? I'm sure there are some very good people at FINRA, but I also know that now the game is, for any kind of a firm, if you want to be normal, you have to hire somebody from FINRA to be your compliance guy. It's be like, when they walk in, they got to have one of their guys shake hands with them and stuff. Where is this going, guys? I mean, it's just, and on that end, I mean, I wish Trump would kind of shake that up a little bit. But on one hand, it's really debilitating for people. On the other hand, the people who are Bernie Madoff, they seem to get off just fine. I would absolutely agree with you that somewhere buried in the bowels of, well, did you ever read, you guys, I'm sure you have, remember read Red Storm Rising?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When so the Russians decided they wanted to attack, what, Germany in the West, right? So the first thing they did...
That may be coming soon.
But the first thing the guy said is, okay, we got all these guys that are generals in charge of all these places, and we got all these people and their staffs. Like who's any good? And they found some guy who's what? He was like a two-star general. And they said, this is the guy that really knows what the hell he's doing. So they get him in there, and the first thing he does is fire all the other guys, right? And get rid of them, all of them, and start whipping everybody into shape. Is that something that needs to be happening here?
I followed Trump for quite a few years, and even before I followed him, I've gone back to look at his business practices in Atlantic City. I grew up in South Jersey, and the last referendum I voted for before I left the state was on the casinos in New Jersey. I voted against that because they said, oh, all the money's going to go to education, which I knew was baloney. But I you know, knowing a little bit about what infiltrated Las Vegas, I say this is going to bring the mob in, you know, not that the mob isn't already in New Jersey, but we're going to get more of them in, especially in Atlantic City. And here you have Trump. Trump was totally mobbed up, money laundering for Russian mob, had his protection he was running a protection racket, and he was using the Cosa Nostra out of Philadelphia, Camden, New Jersey, to strong arm people. And that's what he's doing as president. That's what he has been doing. And basically, everything you see is like a protection racket. Oh, that's a nice university you have there. Be a shame if something happened to it, right?
Yeah.
That's a nice law firm you have. It'd be real shame if all he's doing is shaking down people for money.
Well, I try to find nobody, you know. I mean, I think some people are innately honest. You can always count on them, and some people. I mean, I was a non-fan of the guy years and years ago because because for whatever reason, the club that I still belong to, but hardly anybody's in there anymore. There's no traders around. They would get people from the hotel up in the building. A lot of these guys are from New York. I remember one time Trump was here and he sang the national anthem or something. A few guys at the bar were at Cubs, a few guys at the bar were for there. And all he did was regale me. This is probably through the years, three or four sets of these guys. just regale me with Trump stories about not paying this guy and doing this guy. But
yeah.
But nobody, even him, nobody's a total idiot. I mean, his sense, he's been on the other side of the street in the sense that he's dealt with government before. Now, if I was made president, I'd have a stern talking to the SEC. I mean, hey, the payment for order flow stuff, all the stuff that's going on in the industry, this is nuts, in my opinion. Now, does that make me some wild man from the outside? Plus, and what we see the federal government doing to people, I think in a lot of the cases, he was guilty of some stuff, okay? I also think a few people put him on trial to make a name for themselves. I mean, I honestly believe that. I mean, nobody's all good or all bad, even him. And the idea that somebody could run up a $45 million legal bill on a citizen, which is what he is, I think is so appalling. It's not hate or dislike of one guy. I think he has an amazing skill set of knowing what other people think. I mean, he's no idiot. I mean, I would never call him that. But you see here in Chicago, you guys ever heard of this guy? He's a state senator. He's Emil Jones. He's one of this. You know, they went after Madigan and got him. Now it's Emil Jones.
Yeah.
The feds are after him, and they end up with a hung jury.
Yeah.
But they're going to try him again. And I'm sitting there going, okay, how the hell does anybody he better have stolen 10 times more than they think he stole to be
well,
able
that's
to,
what happened at Blagojevich,
yeah,
remember
yeah.
It was like, yeah
he
yeah.
better have stolen 10 times more than they think he stole to be able to pay. Nobody should be able to do that to anybody. I mean, in this country, suppose he gets hung jury the second time, is a guy going to have a nickel to how can you do that to somebody?
Chief, you've identified problems, serious problems that need correcting. Too much paperwork, too much bureaucracy. And I saw it when I took time out as a reporter, and I was a landlord in a city, and way too much regulation is frustrating. But are the people who are identifying the problem actually providing solutions, or are they just creating a ruckus about the problems to do the same kind of things themselves?
I think selection B there.
Yes, exactly. So if you were running things, you would identify problems and try to solve them. A lot of these politicians or other people, they identify the problem and then they think, how can I make the best of it for myself or my crew? And that's not right. But here's the founding fathers. They identified Congress as the main branch and the states as extremely important. And somehow we've evolved to a system where Congress is basically doesn't do anything, and now we're seeing in LA and otherwise that the states don't mean anything. That's not our system. Our system is not one president runs pretty much everything.
That's not your system, not Wayne's system, not my system. How do we know that it's not the Americans of today's system?
Well, I know one thing. Right now, it's Russia's system. And Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, sent out a congratulatory message today on honoring Russia's National Day. Now, that's something we haven't done, apparently, since 2022, when they invaded Ukraine. And but, you know, the official name of Russia is the Russian Federation. Its constituent parts actually have more autonomy than even our own states. But that used to be the case. But the first thing Putin did is he went after the sovereignty of the constituents of the Russian Federation. They no longer have elections. He appoints their governors. And, you know, if left unchecked, we could see Trump, you know, doing something like that here.
What if we were to put the Enabling Act to a vote in our Congress right now, how many votes you think it would get? Now, the Enabling Act was... first of all, explain what the Enabling Act is to everybody.
Well, the Enabling Act was... okay, so Hitler became the Chancellor of Germany when the President of the Weimar Republic, General von Hindenburg, appointed him as part of a coalition. He couldn't get in just with his own Nazi party. He had to go into a coalition with the centrist, what they called the Catholic Party, and that happened. And they thought everything was going to be fine, because then the centrist party will be a check on Hitler. That was up until the Reichstag burned down. And it's clear that it was, although they blamed it on a communist, it's clear that it was set by the, you know, the SS, Gestapo. So Hitler goes before, first thing he does, he has all the communist deputies in the Reichstag arrested, and he prevents socialist members from sitting. So now he's got a clear supermajority, and he puts through the Enabling Act, which basically tore up the Constitution of Germany, and it basically also declared him, you know, the judge, jury, and executioner. Well,
You're right, he rigged the boat, but Congress essentially voted themselves out of existence.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And and right now in the House, if there was something like that, a lot of people said the Patriot Act was a lot like that after 9/11. I actually might have been one of them, but we like they say, we hadn't seen anything yet. I think it would probably pass very easily with Trump threatening anyone who votes against it.
I think
going to find out.
I think we
the hard way.
How much of it is a person? You know, I'll use the name Trump. How much of it is a person, or how much of it is he just getting the sense of the times. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been, you know, we still go out a couple nights a week, different age groups at the table, and you'll constantly hear in what I think is some, you know, really ignorant comment where somebody will be like it's a jury trial, and yeah. All of a sudden somebody's not guilty or somebody's guilty, and somebody will get like a tweet. Well, everybody knows that it was the guy was really guilty or really not guilty, and I'll say something old and dumb like, you know, there were 12 people that sat there for a friggin' month and listened to this for 8 hours a day, and you get one tweet and you know more than they do. How does that work? but yeah. But that's what you're not going to talk somebody out of that. I mean, what in today's world, what do you need Congress for? They're so damn slow, all they do is fight. They don't realize that that's how it was designed to be, so people didn't run roughshod over people. But they don't like that. What are we doing? Why do we need these guys? Trump looks to me like either I'm not so sure that if, well, you know, the, I don't know if I mentioned last week, you weren't on, Andrew, but I think I might have mentioned Andrew. You look at, and this is going to sound really weird, you know, hopefully you still want to come on after I say this. You look at Trump and you look at Johnson here in the city of Chicago. If you strip away the politics and the color and you listen to him, it's the exact same person. It's my way or the highway. I got it all figured out. By the way, anybody around me is going to be a loyalist before they're talented. I mean, an ounce of talent is not worth a pound of loyalty. You know, an ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of talent. And I got my own way of doing things. I got this gut feel, and I got it all figured out. They're the exact same person. And yet, they're on totally opposite ends. And that's where I think a real lot of Americans, who is it with this big thing up with Musk and Trump? Was it, wasn't Mark Cuban, it was somebody like that, that said, why don't we get ourselves a third party for the 80% of the Americans that don't want any of this crap on either side?
Oh, well, you know, that's been Andrew Yang's position for a while, and a few of these tech bros. But, you know, they actually have an aversion to democracy.
Well, you think this is democracy?
Well, I don't know. You know, these tech bros, if you read what they write, it's like, you know, they want to turn everything over to an AI.
Yeah, well, that's true.
They've identified the problem, and then they want to be the solution for their own greater wealth and glory. So I actually agree with your analysis a few moments ago, Tom. And
well, there's two of us then. There's two of us.
But what's the solution? The solution is more nuanced accountability from the press, from independent analysts that we can trust to hold these people to account. But all of those independent centers of accountability are being diminished. And just to take a quick example, I see we're kind of running out of time.
We got time. We got a few minutes.
But members of Congress who are in our movies and civic culture, they're supposed to have so much power. Very little, actually. In fact, I may have told this story, but one time I'll repeat it. I was on a small plane going from D.C. to New Haven, and I was sitting next to a very experienced Democratic Congresswoman, Rosa DeLauro, whose husband is a big Democratic pollster.
She's the one with the purple hair now.
Yeah, purple hair. And I was explaining some of the things I was looking into, probably stories that Wayne had broken. And as we're approaching New Haven, she says, "This is horrible. You've got to do something about this." And I said, "What, me? I'm just a reporter. You're a member of Congress." And she said, "We can't do anything."
Yeah.
Well, I think they can only do what people want, but then they can lead a little bit, but you can't lead too far in advance. I mean, it's just, we know that's the way of the world, but I think that a lot of people don't feel that they have anybody on, unless you're really a MAGA, and there are some, and maybe, I mentioned the story yesterday, you guys didn't hear it, I don't think, but I was out walking last weekend, and I see this people getting stuff done by this Mexican family, right? And I'm talking to them, and I talked to the guy a little bit, and I kind of sensed he was sort of a MAGA dude, and I said, well, you know, these people are the enemy. He goes, what are you talking about? And I said, well, in this day and age, I'm going to say that they are the enemy. They you've been told, and people believe now, that even if you live in Wyoming and you've never met an illegal migrant, that somehow they're ruining your life, and you know, that they are the enemy, and if you don't get them out of here one way or the other, you know, pretty much dead or alive, we don't, you know, that's probably a little too extreme, but this is somehow tearing your life apart. And I said, oh, by the way, I think you just paid these people, and I couldn't find his house again. I was walked through the whole place, and it was raining. And I said, by the way, you're now aiding and abetting. You could go to jail. He looks at me like I got four heads. I said, that's what. If we take this to the extreme, you're going to be checking everybody's papers everywhere you go. And if you don't, I mean, where are we going with this? I said to the guy, because I knew he was enemy. He had a Trump thing in his window or something. Where are we going with this exactly? He didn't want to talk to me anymore. I mean, where are we going with this? Where you're checking everybody's papers everywhere you go? I mean, what are we doing?
And not only that, we got this vainglorious parade on Saturday, and I think there's well over almost 30 M1 Abrams tanks that are going to be going down Constitution Avenue, and a bunch of armored vehicles, and of course Trump will be there. It's supposedly the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army, but it's also Trump's birthday, 79, not even the 80th. Washington, and now you see tanks being transported through the town, and then you juxtapose that with what you're seeing in Los Angeles, where the cops are using horses to kettle people into small groups, and then they say they're all under arrest when they're trying to get out. But this was a tactic they used in New York back during, I think it was the 2004 Republican convention. They kettle people into areas where they're not able to disperse, and then they arrest them for failure to disperse.
Well, this is going to be maybe not important but really stupid question. Don't tanks running down a street tear the whole street up?
Oh, yeah. There's tens of millions of dollars have been allocated to repair the streets. And so while we're cutting out medical research, we're going to be spending this money to repair the D.C. streets. Maybe they just leave it filled with potholes. But
worse than that, they don't know some of these streets where the tanks are going to be you've got DC metro stations right under those streets, and they're not even certain whether the weight of those tanks might cause a collapse.
They don't care
because the Republican Congress, there's some Republican Congress, and it's called the Washington Metropolitan Transit Authority. He wants it to be changed to the MAGA and call the subway the Trump train. They don't care about public transit.
How much
whatsoever.
If this is moving forward even more rapidly than I thought, some people are cheering it. Just let it go. In a year, everything's gonna be perfect. Whatever they're doing, just don't pay attention to details. The guy's got such a vision that that everything's gonna be fine. What is the feeling among, let's say, the Republican rank and file? Right now I think they're categorically on board because they're afraid of retribution, but do they think it's going to eventually turn into some superpower center, or do they think it's going to be the demise of their party? When you talk to these guys, when I never talked to them, what are they thinking? Do you have any idea?
I think a lot of them are very privately worried about the country, worried about their own future, and ultimately they're keeping their mouth shut. But just today we see reporting that Rand Paul realized he's not invited to the annual congressional reception at the White House because he criticized President Trump. Now, he's pretty outspoken senator from Kentucky, so he can take it. But most of them, they realize that at the current moment, they do not dare criticize anything that the president is doing. We'll see if that changes.
Well, you had the vice president said it's unwise to criticize the president. I mean, these are absolute out and out threats. You know, nobody did this 10 years ago.
Oh yeah.
Well, look at the threat against Newsom. They said he had to be tarred and feathered, and that. That's
you're coming from a guy from Louisiana. That's probably not a good, a good visual.
Yeah, a char and feather. If we watch the cartoons, it's maybe amusing at Looney Tunes. That's 100% certainty of death.
Yeah.
And so that's a death threat. And when someone went, I'm forgetting the names. Maybe you guys remember who said what. But then when they went and said, is this legal? What's the crime that you're calling for tar and feathering of Newsom, the governor? And the answer was, well, he was elected governor of California.
So yeah, that was Trump. They said, what law did he break? Well, he ran for governor. That's why he should be put in prison.
I don't really think the Constitution anticipated anything like this ever.
Those who drafted the Constitution were by and large gentlemen. Now they may have been they may have been ruffians in other respects, but they were gentlemen. And how could a gentleman ever contemplate a ruffian like Donald Trump? And they couldn't.
Well, I don't know, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but somebody wrote this article, and, you know, you pick bits and pieces out of every article, hopefully not just the ones you agree with, but I'm saying that the weakest part of the Constitution is the executive branch, because they knew Washington was going to be president, and everybody after him was going to be like him. You know, and that hasn't worked out, not just with Trump, but other people along the way as well.
They had a problem with John Adams right afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, well, guys, good stuff. Andrew, I'm glad your thing went pretty good. 55 years, wow, that's a while. How many guys are still there from your gang?
Exactly. Great to be with you.
What? How many people from your class were there?
Maybe about 120. I actually didn't register for the official activities. I was going to be with my rowing and student buddies, and then I organized this town hall. But I did close down the beer tents both nights.
Good for you.
Registered for that. But I think there were about 120.
I'm sure Wayne is very jealous when he heard that.
Wow! Yeah, and you know, and also there was a lot of the younger members of the opposite sex were at some of those beer tents, right?
Well, I avoided disgracing myself by, I think.
Yeah, when you go from being pops to grandpops, it's kind of a rough deal.
I do remember saying to one guy who was, it was my joke, because I think the guy was maybe 5 years younger, but I think I said, but I didn't act on it, hey, I see your granddaughter over there. I think I'll go talk to her. That was a joke.
Oh, God. Anyway, you guys, take care. SP Futures down 11, NASDAQ Futures down 33. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.